Well, I think part of the sourcing process to me is the most exciting, because you know, you rent a car and you drive through the south of France, and you know, you obviously have some appointments set up, but you know, some of the most exciting things happen when you're just kind of winging it. And you meet a farmer at, you know, a wine fair, and he's, you know, he says, well, come back to my estate, and you're not quite sure where you're going, and you follow a guy in a Peugeot, you know, up a rambling hill, and all of a sudden you come across either a castle or like a shack in the woods, and the guy's making wine out of the back of his, you know, house, or he could be making wine out of a major estate. You know, looks are deceiving, but you want to assume that someone with a very established chateau is making good wine. But 9 times out of 10, the guy out of the garage who's like super passionate is making these better wines, and they're maybe more rustic and less polished. So to me, like the restaurateur, the sommelier, this story resonates with them about the small farmer, you know, the guy who's making wine on small quantities, 80 cases, 100 cases. Those are the things exciting to Barterhouse, and hopefully the things exciting to our clients.
Welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting from 2 shipping containers at Roberta's Pizza at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we are the Garden Ladies. We can call ourselves ladies now, right, Alice?
Yes. Groundworks, Inc.
Despite what you see on Facebook, we are ladylike. We design, build, and maintain gardens all around New York. And this show aims to bring the culture to horticulture.
That's right.
And what better topic that would demonstrate that aim is than botanical Latin.
Right.
Right, Alice?
Right.
So on this week's show, we begin with the first part of a two-part series on botanical Latin. And before you start yawning and rolling your eyes back into your heads, listen, this is important stuff.
It's actually really important stuff.
Yeah.
It's kind of about sex and location.
Have we got your attention now?
Hi, Scott.
Yes, and I have lots to talk about on that subject.
Okay, well, Good. Let's explain who Scott is. He's not just a voice from
the
outer
ether.
Space.
Now, for those of you who don't know who Scott is, shame on you. I'm gonna tell you who he is. He is our favorite horticultural taxonomist and friend, and he's calling in from Vieques, Puerto Rico. And he's going to help us understand why botanical Latin matters and how to decipher it. Scott Appel is the green man, the original green man, before green was greenwashing everything.
Before green was a design term.
That's right. He was. That's right. Scott is a self-professed culinary horticulturist, and although he is a professional horticultural taxonomist, which makes him uniquely qualified to talk on this topic, he is also a trained baker, a chef, and culinary historian. He combines all these disciplines into one when he explains to his cooking and gardening students the history of the diverse herbs, fruits, and vegetables used in the kitchen or cultivated in both temperate and tropical gardens. He is the author of several books and innumerable articles. He lives, teaches, writes, cooks, and gardens in Vieques, Puerto Rico. Scott. So let's talk Latin, botanical Latin.
Well, semper ubi sub ubi, always wear underwear.
Do the hokey pokey.
Wait, but I don't think you follow that proverb. Now, do you?
Well, let's not get too personal.
That's right. Well,
back to our lessons, everyone.
Back to the plants.
It's not television, at least. you know, I've been in horticulture. You know, I've been in horticulture my whole life, and I've been studying botanical Latin because I think it's really fascinating, and knowing the scientific names of plants to me is riveting. you know, although other people, of course, would be bored to tears. But in all the classes I've given, you know, throughout my career, people really whine. Oh, I hate these Latin names. Why do I have to know these names? Right. I can't even say these names.
Can't I just call it the Fuzzy Wuzzy Plant or some silly, stupid name?
Right. You know, and you keep that, and you keep that thought in mind, because that's a really big segue. What you just said.
Yeah. It's the root of it, so to speak. But
you know, and well, you know, why do we need to know? You know, you read gardening books and you have the Latin names, and you know, you go to a nursery and there's the plant tag,
right?
And it has an English and a Latin name, but you know, why bother?
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a couple of big stories to tell, and this is one, and this really exemplifies why I thought we should do this program together.
Okay.
As folks know, you know, you and Alice and I used to work at the Horticultural Society of New York. Although we had different jobs, my job was director of education, and I would fence horticultural questions from the public. They could be authors, they could be writers, they could be just, you know, a simple person with a houseplant question.
Right.
Didn't matter. I got a call once, and you were behind me, Carmen, as a matter of fact, sitting at your desk, from a lady from the Deep South, and she had a really heavy Southern accent.
Can I play her in the movie?
And you may. Okay. I have no idea what you look like, but you certainly may, or I could.
All right, Scott, tell the story, please.
So the woman says, you know, I'm writing an article about mother-in-law's tongue.
Right.
And I'd like to check, you know, facts check, and may ask you some questions. And I said, yes, of course, you know. Well, is it true that mother-in-law's tongue comes from South Africa? And I said, well, no, it really comes from tropical West Africa. So I can hear her writing. Is it true that mother-in-law's tongue is used for making fabrics, coarse fabrics? And I said, well, no, it doesn't have any persistent plant parts. It's really, you know, herbaceous. And she goes on to ask me another question. I said, well, do you know that in tropical West Africa, a groom will ceremoniously feed his new mother-in-law the plant leaves because it makes her mouth swell up, literally, so she would, like, shut up, so to speak? She
right.
said, and no. I know. I didn't hear that before. And I finally said, what plant are you talking about?
Uh-huh.
Oh, well, I can't really say the name. I said, just try. She said, oh, it's Sansevieria. And I said, I'm talking about Diefenbachia.
Right.
So we're talking about two completely different plants.
Yeah.
We went through all the questions, you know, of course, and you know, and her information was correct. The point is, not only do common names confuse us, of course, I was in Manhattan, and what she called mother-in-law's tongue, I would call dumb cane, you know, dumb cane, mm-hmm. the houseplant.
Mm-hmm.
But in the South, it's mother-in-law's tongue. And to me, mother-in-law's tongue is a different plant completely.
Right.
So
yeah.
We were totally miscommunicating.
Right.
And that's the importance of botanical Latin,
right.
or biological Latin, is that you can speak to someone or write to someone. Of course, you may not even know Japanese or Russian, but if you say the plant name, they know what you're talking about.
Right.
And that's incredibly important, especially when you're in the profession. So somebody, you know, you're not getting mixed up.
Right. Another example is Rose of Sharon. That's the common name.
Yes.
And it actually is the common name for two separate plants, Hypericum calcicolor or calcicinum, which is the ground cover.
Uh-huh.
And then it's also a common name for Hibiscus syriacus, which is the shrub, you know, which blooms at the end of shrummer, at the end of the summer, shrummer, shrub, neither of which is a rose. So that's a very serious misnomer. And gardeners, you know, they see something they like, and they're given the common name, but that isn't at all what they end up with when they are at the retail nursery buying something.
And I think people are intimidated to pronounce the Latin. I know I am, even though for years in the gardening profession, I get intimidated with some of these names and how to pronounce them. And I remember one time Alice and I were doing some work for a family member of Lyndon Miller, who I think you know, Scott.
She's
a public garden designer, for those of you who don't know who she is, here in New York, one of the most eminent public garden designers. And she said that one of her greatest regrets was that she didn't insist on her children learning all the plant names in Latin, but she was going to correct that with her grandchildren, and she would insist that they would learn all the plants by their Latin names or botanical names.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because
it's wonderful.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you something, and not to sound prideful or anything, a lot of times I don't even remember the common name. I only know the Latin name.
No, I know.
So, so I'm the opposite field. It's like, I don't know what it's called, but it's,
but it's this, right? Well, because as I understand it, the Latin, although it's not true Roman classical ancient Latin, it's more a hybrid of Latin and Greek, and it's more a descriptive of where it grows and how it grows, and that's the importance, and that's what's going to differentiate between the species.
And actually, we'll touch base on that, because even though we say botanical Latin, it is not the spoken language. And I have a whole other story to tell you, maybe the second part of this half hour.
Okay.
Which was greatly embarrassing, because I give the class, and I gave it to Latin speakers, and that was...
Oh, that must have been interesting, actually.
I'll tell you this. We'll get to that story. But no, it is not classic spoken language. It is really an amalgam of languages, and we'll get to how plants get their names, and I bet we do that later on, maybe the second half hour.
Right. This is going to be a two-part two-part series.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, we're
huge.
Only going to scratch the surface. It's huge. And, of course, I love to blather on, and so we need to be succinct. But
well, can you tell us, Scott, briefly, why was it... I did some research on this as well, but maybe you can share as well. Why was Latin chosen as the language of science, and specifically for botany and for plant science?
Oh, well, actually, it's very easy. First, I'll say about pronunciation. Just like Spanish and just like Italian, when you look at a Latin name, whether it's an animal or a plant, every vowel makes a new when you break up a word, I just forgot the word.
You mean a compound word? Compound word?
Yeah, every vowel
syllable?
Makes a new syllable. Yes.
Right, okay.
So, for example, one of the classic mistakes is you look at the word, the genus, cotoneaster. Everyone in college the first time says cotton easter, because that's how it looks. But it's really cotoneaster. But the reason Latin is used is because Latin was the language of the intelligentsia.
Right, in Europe.
Of the educated.
Of the educated, right.
You know, Julius Caesar didn't speak Italian. That was vulgar. He spoke Latin.
Mm-hmm.
Desiderius Erasmus in the 1500s spoke Latin. He was Dutch, of course, but whenever he wrote to his friends in Europe and Russia, he wrote in Latin. they wouldn't understand Dutch.
Right. It was the common language.
It was the language of the church, Scott, of diplomacy, right?
Yes.
Right.
It was
and it was the written language for herbalists and botanists who were the doctors who were dealing in medicine, right?
Precisely. Yes, precisely. It was a pharmacology and science. So that's why Latin was chosen as the basis. But of course, it's not, classical Latin. It's not that language. Once again, it's a conglomerate.
Right. But it really is also like a structural compound for classification, right? I mean, because the plant world is based on these kind of certain set structure rules. So this language was evolved to kind of determine what these rules are, right? It's an order. Latin is really an order.
Well, the Latinization, we as humans, we need to categorize stuff.
Right.
It's just our nature. And, you mentioned, why can't we call this plant, the fuzzy plant, whatever that was?
Yeah, I just made something up, right.
Well, that's what people used to do.
Mm-hmm.
The man that developed this whole system is Carl Linnaeus,
mm-hmm.
a Swedish botanist. He lived 1707 to 1778, and he lived in Uppsala, Sweden, which is north of Stockholm. And in fact, his home is still there as a museum. It's actually really quite beautiful and rustic. He devised this system of naming plants and animals. He named animals as well.
Right.
When you go to college, you learn it as the binomial epithet, which is, of course, a big mouthful, meaning the two-name system.
Mm-hmm.
Every creature on Earth has two names. The first name is a genus. The second name is a species.
Homo sapien. Right.
Yes, and that means, and that's us,
right.
Homo sapiens, meaning knowledgeable humans. But, of course, the way we act these days, that's probably a really inappropriate name. Every creature has a two name, but it gets more complex, and we'll get to that as well.
And Linnaeus also, he was the first to sort of name all the parts of the plant, Scott, right? Like from the root to the stem to the flower. And he was the one that focused on the reproductive organs within the flower, right? To categorize them and to be much more systematic than just, external descriptions, right?
Well, he called his system the simple sexual system. Now, going back to the fuzzy plant part, and you'll see where the segue is going. Don't forget, this is in the 1700s. Johann Sebastian Bach died 1750. Handel died 1760. So you can, America became free from England 1776.
Mm-hmm.
So you can place this historically.
Right.
But before, but in the 1600s, a century earlier, Holland started, the Dutch East India Company, and they were like the threshold of explorers, nautical
mm-hmm.
explorers, discovering plants.
Mm-hmm.
So, and people were just naming plants willy-nilly, like the big fuzzy plant, or the plant with the big red leaves. And this plant has to be related to that because it's got big red leaves also.
Yeah. Right.
So it was totally malarkey. And not scientific. And Linnaeus comes along. People were really pissed off at Linnaeus. And he decides he's going to categorize plants by their reproductive organs, the simple sexual system.
Mm-hmm.
So people, when you go for a garden tour, people will say, oh, isn't that related to so-and-so? Well, no. Well, it's got the leaves just like it. Well, no.
Right.
It's all about how the flowers are set up.
Mm-hmm.
How many petals? How many stamens? Is the ovary a pygnus or a pogynous? He devised it all. It's all thanks to him.
Right.
But it's all about the flowers. And in fact, the simple sexual system, of course, it really works. And you can key out And we've all seen, you know, flower guides where, you know, you key out a plant. Women in the 1700s were forbidden or discouraged from studying botany and horticulture. And here's why. For example, pudica in Latin means shy. If I said Mimosa pudica, you may not know that name, but that's the sensitive plant. I'm sure you've seen that before.
Uh-huh.
Well, you touch the leaves and they fold up.
Right.
Pudica meaning shy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, impudica means the opposite, not shy. Well, there's a kind of mushroom, and the genus is Phallus, Phallus.
I see where you're going with this.
Uh-huh. So you've got the unshy Phallus. And when you look at it, it erupts out of the ground like, you know, a giant penis.
And the ladies and were discouraged from
learning these words.
That,
right,
know. Right.
And there's another plant. We have it here on the Aegis. It's actually from India. It's a vine. It's fabaceous. That tells us it's a pear bean cousin. Blue and white flowers. The genus is Clitoria. And when you look at the plant, the flower, exactly,
uh-huh.
you think, I mean, the illusion is like
there.
Letting the face.
Right.
So we're talking about penises and clitorises.
Right.
Women in the 1700s were, you know, not allowed to study any of that.
Yeah, right.
But
Georgia O'Keeffe was not around yet.
No, but give it another 100 years.
Right.
After Darwin, horticulture and botany was considered a very worthwhile pastime for
ladies.
Yes.
And some of the best botanical artists, of course, were women who went to South Africa and the Caribbean and the Amazon.
Right.
To paint.
Right.
So, you know, a century makes a whole lot of difference, although you get the picture, and this is not really about botanical Latin. Just a segue.
Sure. Well, we're going to have to take a little bit of a break, and we want to hear more stories relating to that, Scott.
Mm-hmm.
So stay tuned, everybody. We'll be right back.
It's otherworldly, but the source is as commonplace as the ground we walk on, the air we breathe. The sound comes from plants through sensitive electronic devices which translate fluctuations of energy. Some call it a voice. Whatever it is, it raises the astonishing possibility that plants can communicate.
Hi, welcome back. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Today's topic is botanical Latin with our longtime friend and Latin and horticulture expert, Scott Appel, calling in from Vieques. So
Hello.
So in the first part of the show, we were talking about phalluses and clitorises. So what are we going to talk about next?
We're talking about sex and classification. You just wanted to say those words.
I did.
Again.
I just wanted to say it on the radio. Where's the FCC?
I know, it's crazy, isn't it?
So, Scott, tell us some more about the origin of Latin and plants.
Well, botanical Latin, as I mentioned, really is an amalgam. In fact, I'm going to read you something. It's just a sentence. It's the language of science and botany and biology. And even though we're talking about the scientific names of plants, their descriptions, when were written down, were in botanical Latin as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just going to read you this, and I'll translate it. It's just one quick line.
Okay.
Species scapo conspicue bracteato pubescente petalus glandiosis unteris genicio paolo longirobis. Now, that's a description of a plant. Now, if you gave that sentence to Julius Caesar or Elizabeth I or, you know, a Latin speaker, they would read it as kind, with a stem conspicuously glistening like gold and reaching the age of puberty, with a thin metal plate full of kernels, with the medicines from the flowers a little longer than the women's restroom. Okay, so it doesn't mean anything to a Latin speaker.
It reminds me of that telephone game that we all played as a kid. Remember where you would whisper something to one person and then somebody would...
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Right? And then by the end, it was totally this, like, ridiculous, skewed, you know... made no sense at all.
You're asking me to do what?
Yeah. What you talking about, Willis? Yeah.
You know, so this sentence to a Latin speaker means nothing.
Right.
To a botanist, it means, well, it means everything, I suppose, because it's giving you a detailed description. And in fact, it doesn't tell you what plant they're talking about. But I think it must be something like, what's a blue flower? Cornflower.
Chicory?
No, cornflower. Jeepers, I forget the genus.
Centaurea.
And Centaurea, of course, means gray, and the leaves are sort of grayish green. Plant names mean something. They are descriptions.
Right.
Of the plant itself, and we'll get into that far more in the next half hour.
Yeah.
So you said you had another story, Scott, about how botanical Latin, sort of an anecdotal story about how botanical Latin impacted you in a situation in a seminary. Is that true?
Oh, well, you know, of course, you know, I give a lecture, and it's usually an hour, and I've given it at the Brooklyn Botanic Gardens, at the Horticultural Society, at the New York Botanical Gardens. Well, I get a call, and this is back at the Horticultural Society, from a seminary in New Jersey. And they say, oh, well, we don't want an hour. We want an hour and a half. And I said, okay, you know, that's fine if you want to be so bored. I took the train out there, and... Of course, it's a seminary school. These are men and women who, I guess, are becoming priests or maybe nuns.
Religious school, right.
Right. And they're taking Latin as the spoken language.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
As part of the curriculum.
Right. Classical Latin.
Classical Latin. And, of course, there I am. And there's a man in the class. He says, do you mind if I record this?
No,
of course not. Well, he's asking me about dangling participles and gerund nouns, and I kept having to say, botanical Latin is not the spoken language. It is a formula for naming plants, because it's got Greek in there. And when we talk about real plant names, they could be languages from, you know, the Native American Indians. Or the Amazon Indians,
but
or people in South Africa.
Right, but they're Latinized. But they're Latinized somehow.
Well, and they're Latinized, but it's not. It's you can't speak it.
Right.
Well, because you know, these are college people, they couldn't understand.
Probably they couldn't even understand why you were there.
Well, after a while, I couldn't understand why I was there. We got through the class, you know, and it was just fine, but I thought, they're not getting it. It's like they're too smart.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because they're taking it as, you know, like you would take French or Spanish.
Literally, right. Well, another example of this for our listeners is, the plant baby's breath, right? Gypsophila. It's that white spray, you know, beautiful, sweet little flower. If you're talking about Gypsophila paniculata, that's grown in very calcium rich soil, right? Like it's a gypsum lover.
Well, Philo, like Philadelphia, city of love.
Uh-huh.
Philo means love. Gypso, like gypsum,
uh-huh.
tells you it's gypsum loving, and paniculata tells you how the flowers are set up.
Exactly. Versus gypsophilia repens, which is a low-growing, repens meaning creeping, habit.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's you know, it's the genus name plus the species name, right? And the genus name is usually a noun that's capitalized, and the species name is the adjective which describes the noun, which will tell you the most about the plant height and the bloom time, etc.
Yes, but not always. Okay. There's always exceptions to the rule.
Sure, but the
here's a mouthful.
Okay,
and you know this plant. We're talking about most plants have two names. Sometimes they have more. And you know, Camisipora specifera folifera oleanana.
Right.
You know,
we use it all the time.
I know you do. It's golden thread leaf Camisiporus.
Right.
Camisiporus. Based on Latinized Greek, cami for the word ground, cyprus like the word cypress, mm-hmm. ground cypress. Pacifera, I-F-E-R-A, means to have or to bear. We'll come across that lots of times in the next half hour. P-I-S-I, from pisum, the genus of pea. So we have ground cypress that bears peas. Why peas? Because the little green cones, of course, it's conifer, look like little peas. Then folifera, once again, I-F-E-R-A, to bear. F-I-L-A, phylla, like the word filament, thread-bearing. Aurea, meaning golden. Nana, meaning dwarf.
Right.
Dwarf, thread-leaf, golden, Camisiporus. I grow bananas here, and they... In Spanish, you would say guineo nano. They're dwarf bananas, so it's the same word in Spanish. So a lot of times plants have more than one name, and it's a mouthful. What Linnaeus tried to stop with his binomial system was plant names, like I just mentioned, where there are five names. What a mouthful.
Right.
What a lot to remember.
Yeah.
But in the 1600s and early 1700s, before he was doing his thing, plants had, 10 names in Latin, and nobody could figure it out. And other people were doing their own thing. It was a mishmash, an unscientific mishmash. And nobody, until Linnaeus, really was getting it straight.
Right.
Was there resistance to his system, Scott, at first? I mean, were people like,
Oh, people were appalled and really pissed off.
You had mentioned that. Why was it? Because of the sexual nature of this, the basis on the sexual...
Well, the Christians hated that because it had to do with sex.
Mm-hmm.
The botanists and the scientists hated it because...
Because somebody was telling them what to...
And stepping on their toes. Yes,
right.
Precisely. And right. Evidently, Linnaeus was arrogant... And
authoritative, probably, and
yeah,
right.
And self-absorbed,
right? Right.
Because I just know this from reading. Obviously, we
right.
don't know.
Oh, you don't know him.
Well, I'm not going to tell you my age, dear.
Well, look, all you got to do is look at a picture of Linnaeus in his Lapland costume, and that'll tell you everything you need to know about him.
yes, his Lapland costume. He used to show up. At like Royal Botanic Garden meetings in that outfit to impress everybody.
Yes.
And in fact, Linnaeus has a plant named after him.
Yeah.
It's called, in English anyway, it's called twin flower. We'll talk about plant names later on. Linnea is the genus, L-I-N-N-A-E-A.
Mm-hmm.
And it was native of Lapland, and he was always pictured when he's painted.
Yes.
Of course, there was no photography, obviously. But when he's ever painted, he's always holding one in his hand. And it wasn't until after his death that it was discovered in northern Canada. It's a Nordic, not Nordic, but, boreal. Well, see, there's another plant name, Borealis. It's a boreal plant in far north.
Uh-huh.
Plant names can tell us, they tell us many, many things. And one of the things they can tell us is longitude and latitude, or direction, borealis, meaning northern, australis, meaning southern.
Mm-hmm.
Australia has a name because continent Australia, because it's so far south. That's what Captain Cook gave it. Occidentalis, meaning western. Orientalis, meaning eastern.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's so, I mean, really, the names are never ending. There's thousands. In fact, his book, meaning Linnaeus's book, The Species Plantarum,
mm-hmm.
there were many editions of it. He described all the plants known to humankind. There had to be tens of thousands in there. And, of course, he had to keep revising it because new plants were discovered all the time. It was amazing. He was amazing.
Didn't he also say, Scott, that he felt that the botanical Latin should not only just be used for naming and classifying the plants, but also that all works relating to plants should also be written in Latin so that everyone could understand it, so that the knowledge could be disseminated throughout, you know, Europe and the rest of the world?
Well, yes. But what happens if you didn't speak Latin? That was the trouble. But, yeah. Of course, Latin was the language, as I said, of the educated and the intelligentsia.
Everyone had to take it. It wasn't an elective, right? If you were a serious scholar, you had to know Latin and Greek. In fact, I told this to Alice recently. Max, my son, who's in junior high, is going to have 3 years of Latin.
Which is
extremely rare to see today.
I think that's great.
It's fantastic. I can't believe that a public school in New York City is requiring Latin.
Mandatory
for 3 years.
No, I think it's great because I think in this age of quick information off the internet, I think you really forget kind of the classical roots of these words and how language, how understanding the roots of these words can transform your language and your knowledge of history and current events and world, you know, world economics. You can't ignore, it. And I think it's really important, especially in this age of, you know, Wikipedia. I think you need to know what you're reading, you know, and SATs and, you know, learning other languages. And
it's definitely helped. I mean, he's learned how much of the English language is based in Latin and Greek,
right,
too.
Yeah.
And he would not have known that otherwise. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But also and it's a way of understanding the natural world around you. And I think we have to, you know, put considerable effort towards that.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't exist anymore.
Yes. No, I absolutely agree. But like everything else, it's not for everybody.
No.
You need to really want to explore it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You can't shove it down people's throats.
No, exactly.
Well, yes, we can. Now that we have a radio program, we can
don't touch that dial.
Yeah, don't you dare. Because unfortunately, we have to. Because
part two is coming up.
We have to stop the show for today. But
we'll be back next week.
We're going to be back next week to do part two of Botanical Latin, and we're going to, with Scott, help you understand how to decipher it in more depth and also how to pronounce it perhaps a little bit, which I always have trouble with.
Exactly.
So that's it for today on We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We'd like to thank Jack Inslee for producing. I wish I could say that in Latin, but maybe I will after part two. Thanks for listening.
Happy gardening.
Bye.